And hello. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and hoping that you're doing well today and that you're joining us today right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network. And such a pleasure to be on board as a host right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And, you know, all of the shows here on PRN are archived. That means you can catch us live, our show, every Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., and that's Eastern Time. Or you can listen anytime on the archives, anytime you want, which I think is such a wonderful adjunct to what they have available right here on Progressive Radio Network. So today we are going to have as our guest Dr. Keith McCormick, and we'll be talking about his new book, Osteoporosis, What You Need to Know to Reduce Your Fracture Risk. And Dr. Keith McCormick is a chiropractic physician with a private practice in Western Massachusetts, which must be nice and white up there today, where he specializes in the nutritional management of patients with bone fragility and also in the treatment of sports injuries. Dr. McCormick graduated from Stanford University with a degree in human biology and then went on to earn his doctorate at the National College of Chiropractic. He is a member of the American Society for Bone and Mineral Research, the International Bone and Mineral Society, and the Institute for Functional Medicine. Dr. McCormick is a certified chiropractic sports physician with a membership in the ACA Council on Sports Injuries and Physical Fitness. He certainly knows a lot about this from his own life because he was a member of the United States Olympic team competing in the Olympiad in Montreal. Dr. Keith is the author of The Whole Body Approach to Osteoporosis. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Keith.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you've certainly had a long history in sports yourself. So why don't we delve back into your past and talk about what brought you up to being a chiropractic physician?
Wow. Well, that's really actually an interesting story. I have trained for the Olympics. I've been training my whole life. I started running when I was 5 or 6 years old, actually, and when I saw the Mexico Olympics in 1968 on television, I said, that's what I want to do, and I just started training ever since then. So, that's essentially been my life, just training, trying to compete in different big-time events and make the Olympic team and eventually do triathlons and things like that. So.
Now, that's a lot of heavy-duty work and perhaps something that would be considered overwork on the body because that's not just moderate exercise.
No, you know, training 30, 40 hours a week is definitely not moderate. It can be excessive at times, but to make, you know, to be an elite athlete, you have to train pretty hard.
And that's true. And that's not for everybody, but I do want to say that anyone who listens to our show today can take what you're sharing and really use it in their life, even if they are not triathletes such as yourself.
Well, what I think people don't realize is you can have too little exercise in your life and you can have too much. And if you have too little, then you become weak. You're not as flexible. You're not as coordinated. And those are all really important aspects for your life, especially when you have osteoporosis and you don't want to fall. But you can also train too much, and it's unusual for people to train too much. But too much training causes what's called pro-inflammatory cytokines to be released by your system. And these cytokines, these messengers from your immune system, actually increase inflammation. So it can go both ways. There's a moderation in everything, as they say.
That's true. Now, let's talk about what you would consider too little exercise.
Well, there's a lot of couch potatoes in the world who don't do anything. I mean, I think everybody should exercise at least, you know, three hours a week minimum. And, you know, the more you do up to a certain point, the better. But 3 hours a week would be a minimum.
Well, when you say 3 hours a week, you know, that sounds daunting until you break it down to about how much that would be a day.
Yeah, well, it's really not that much. I mean, you have to realize that even just warming up, stretching a little bit, and then maybe doing some light weights and a little bit of aerobic exercise, you know, you break it up. And so it doesn't have to be all, 45 minutes in a day as being the, you know, a steady state of exercise. You can take 45 minutes and break it up and not only have more fun, but work different aspects of your body. And like I said, you can do stretching to make you more supple. You can do coordination exercises, light weights to build strength. Some part of it can be aerobic. 15, 20 minutes can be aerobic. And, of course, all this, you know, you have to be okayed by your physician to make sure that you're healthy enough to start a new exercise program. But 45 minutes, 4 days a week would do an awful lot to help people's health.
Now, you do talk a lot in your book about osteoporosis. In fact, your book is called The Whole Body Approach to Osteoporosis. So that's kind of an end stage. I mean, we can certainly take care of our bone health long before we get a diagnosis of osteoporosis.
That's true, and when you say end stage, that can be a tricky way to put it, because I was diagnosed at age 45 with severe osteoporosis, so hopefully I wasn't end stage at that point in my life.
Well, I don't mean fatal, but I mean once things can be sort of given a name in conventional medicine, they're sort of way out of line already, so it's so much better to catch things beforehand.
No doubt about it. It's much easier to maintain your bone density than to gain it back. The problem is most people don't know if they have decreased bone density. They don't know if they're at risk for fragility fractures until they get to be 50 when their doctor sends them for a bone density exam. And you're right, they should be working on, you know, health in general when they're in the 20s and 30s, but that would be the ideal that often doesn't happen, unfortunately.
That's so true. Now, so would you suggest that perhaps people request a bone density when they're younger?
A little earlier. Well, that's an incredibly good question. And yes, I would. I was diagnosed, like I said, at age 45, and I wish that I would have known at age 40 that I had low bone density. And if a person has an eating disorder, or they're a heavy smoker or heavy drinker, or they take medications such as prednisone for a disorder, then those people are at higher risk for osteoporosis. And so, yes, I would say they should get a bone density at age, 35 or 40. And for other people who don't have major risk factors, which I had zero risk factors, I would think that, especially for a woman who goes through menopause at usually age 48 or 50, I would like to see people have bone densities even at age 45. And the reason why is because, like I said, it's much easier to find out you have a problem and fix those problems before you continue to lose bone density than to have, to find out that you have osteoporosis, and then it's kind of climbing out of the hole to get back to where you should be.
Well, that's definitely good. Now, in your case, like you said, you had zero risk factors.
Yep.
So how do we explain you having this issue with all the exercise you were doing?
Yeah, that's why I advocate bone density examinations. And they're not the most accurate things in the world. They aren't. They have their flaws. But it's about all we have. And so why not at least pay, and the nice thing about bone density examinations is they're fairly inexpensive. For $225, a person can essentially rule out a major disorder, and it's just such a nice insurance package to say, oh, geez, at least that's one chronic disease I don't have to worry about. So even if insurance doesn't pay for it, I still encourage people to get a bone density at a little bit earlier age, 45 or at least 50. And I know that's that's way earlier than most physicians recommend, but they probably didn't have osteoporosis, and they probably didn't find out that they had osteoporosis at age 45. So I'm a little sensitive on that subject. And
now, what do you think about, the different kinds of scans? Like, I know there's one thing, of course, to get a full spinal X-ray, but what about the ones where they just sort of look at your finger briefly, which, of course, is much less in terms of radiation.
And then there's the ones on that they take a bone density exam of your heel and your foot. And my feeling is, though, bone density is varies throughout a person's body. So you might have a finger that is okay. You might have a heel that has bone density that's okay. But your spine might not be okay. Even when we do full DEXA bone density examinations, where they're examining both the femur, the hip bone, and the spine, there can be huge discrepancies between those two. So you might have a lot of loss in your spine and not so much loss of bone density in the hip. So, and what we're really trying to avoid in life is hip and spine fractures. So for the cost between the two, as far as having a lesser test of a heel examination versus a full DEXA examination, I definitely, there's no question in my mind, a person should have a spinal and hip bone density examination instead.
So you're going to get much more information.
Much more information.
Because if that one area is intact, you're not going to necessarily be able to tell.
And if that heel exam is normal, then you're kind of lulled into thinking, oh, everything is okay, and it might not be okay.
That's interesting. And so, I'm not too fond of X-rays personally. Like, for instance, I have never had a mammography, and I don't get dental X-rays unless my dentist wants to look at a specific tooth, tooth, and I'll let him just do that, and maybe once every many years. So I'm not a big fan of them. But I actually do get an osteoporosis, out.
And the reason why it's so different from what you just said, mammograms, spinal X-rays, they put a huge amount of radiation into you. A bone density examination is very minimal. It's probably 7 sieverts of radiation, which is a very small amount of radiation. It's almost about the amount that you get on a typical day walking around on this earth. So it's very minimal. A spinal X-ray, you might get like 700 sieverts. A bone density examination, you get 7.
So that's really interesting. So there's a different amount, and the bone density is actually less.
Way less, yes. The receiving radiation from a bone density examination should not be anybody's concern.
And I wonder why that is. Are they able to see things more easily?
Well, they're not really looking for things. They're not really, a spinal X-ray, you're looking for fine little subtleties. All we're trying to do with a bone density examination is throw a few bits of radiation through your body to see if it's attenuated or not, to see if it's slowed down by your bones or not. If it's slowed down by your bones, because they're hard, because they contain a lot of calcium, which slows down the radiation, the X-rays, then we know that you have a lot of bone density. That's all we're looking for. We're looking for how much radiation actually gets through your body. We're not trying to discern subtleties. So that's why we only have to put in very minimal amounts of radiation to get the job done.
Well, that's very interesting. That's why I love doing radio shows, because I never knew that differentiation. I actually thought it was basically the same thing as when they do a spinal X-ray. And, of course, as a chiropractor, you're fully familiar with X-ray technique. And as a specialist in osteoporosis, that was a wonderful explanation. And we've had many guests on, everywhere from Alan Gaby when he wrote his book on osteoporosis, which is a long time ago, because that show's been on since the 1980s, and many others as well. So that was really brand new information to me, and I love that. So thank you for it.
You're welcome.
Now, when you got that diagnosis for yourself, I imagine, like you said, you were kind of surprised.
Kind of surprised is an understatement. I was totally floored. the I went into I had been running some I was obviously training for something because I'm always training for some race here or there, and I was doing a hard track workout, and all of a sudden my hips started hurting really badly, and so I could barely run, and ended up having x-rays and bone scan and then a bone density examination. And when the bone density exam was finished, the technician just blurted out very unprofessionally, "Wow, you have worse bone density than a 100-year-old woman."
Wow, shocking.
I was very shocked. I was very distressed. I was very embarrassed that here I am, a 45-year-old guy, and I have a disease of a 100-year-old person. And so it was very, in all my life, I've been trying to be healthy. I try to eat well. I exercise. I'm a male, you know, which supposedly males aren't supposed to get osteoporosis. So it just kind of like shattered all my belief. And so it was incredibly shocking. And I did not tell anybody that I had osteoporosis except my wife, and because I was too embarrassed. I thought, wow, you know, people are going to think that I didn't care for myself. They're going to just think bad things of me. I don't know. I bet, you know, all those thoughts were irrational, I understand, but I was very embarrassed. And over the next 5 years, I had 12 fractures. I would crumble. I was really my spine and my skeleton, my ribs. I was just really crumbling from this. So it was quite distressing.
Yeah, I would imagine it definitely would be. So what was okay? What was the plan of action? After we have a shock, we have to regroup, right? And then say, what's next?
Yeah. Well, I said, you know, I have to fix this, because that's who I am. That's what I am. I don't take things lying down. I attack and I fight back. And so I contacted 5 different endocrinologists, trying to figure out what was going on. Each and every single one of them prescribed me a bisphosphonate.
Right, and, exactly.
To harden up my skeleton. And each and every one of them, I said, you know, I'm not really here for a medication. I'm here to figure out why I have osteoporosis and then to fix it. So the game plan was much different than what I had in my mind, was much different from what was being offered to me.
Okay, right, of course. Well, when we're talking about conventional medicine, that is kind of, you know, they do say lift weights, which you already have been doing, you know,
working out. Yeah, I've done that. Been there, done that, right?
And they do say, you know, take calcium, and other than that, their only answer are pharmaceuticals.
Right, yeah.
Now, did they test your hormone levels to see if there was a low testosterone or anything else that might be linked to that?
Well, the endocrinologist that I ended up choosing, he was a specialist in osteoporosis, and he did quite a lot of testing on me. As I learned more about what to do, then I encouraged more testing, because even though his testing was pretty good, it wasn't completely thorough. He was a great endocrinologist and stuff, but still, they looked at it only from the medical aspect, and I wanted to look a little bit deeper into the functional aspect of my body, so I did even more testing. But yes, they tested my testosterone, which was perfectly fine, 700, which is I don't know if you know anything about testosterone levels, but it was perfectly normal and actually probably a little bit of, maybe above
it's
normal.
It's a little above, yes.
That's right. So no, there was no testosterone problems. There was no nothing problems. No, so
nothing that could, no blood work that could indicate what's going on.
No. Eventually, we did find out some things, but initially, no. But we only found out things later because of the things I did, not necessarily from what the endocrinologist did. And that's why I wrote the book, The Whole Body Approach to Osteoporosis, because my whole feeling is that osteoporosis is not only a chronic disease, but it's actually a very complex disease. And you have to approach osteoporosis with a very sophisticated approach. And that's the name of my book, The Whole Body Approach, because it's a sophisticated approach. It's not just looking at the the bone density, and then saying, well, let's make the bone density harder and think that that's it. When you take a bisphosphonate and you harden up the bone structure, you're doing absolutely nothing for the health of that bone structure. And I knew that...
I want you to describe that in detail, because I'm very familiar with that story, but I'm sure many of our listeners are not, because it does change the number.
Mm-hmm. It changes the number.
It does change the number, yeah. But it doesn't change the health of the bone, not yeah. in a positive direction. So yeah. explain to our listeners why you would say that.
Well, because if you take a person with, let's say, a negative 3.0 on a bone density examination, then you take another person with a negative 3.0, exactly the same age, same sex, both women, both 55 years old, they both have a spinal bone density of a negative 3.0, they will fracture at different rates. They will have, each of them will have actually a different risk factor for fracturing. And the reason why is because the quality of their bone is different. So when you look at a piece of bone under a microscope, the trabecula, the little bitty fine struts and bars that kind of hold bone together, might have little defects in them. The collagen that makes them up might have cross linkages in them that make them stiff and not supple. The hydroxyapatite crystals, the crystals that impregnate that collagen, might not be as normal as it should be. So there's a lot of the quality aspects of a bone that can be different. A person can have high inflammation in their body, and when a person has, like for say, if we did a homocysteine test, it's a blood test, or a C-reactive protein test. Those are inflammatory tests that you can measure inflammatory markers within the body. If those two lab tests are elevated, like for homocysteine, if it's above 8, or if a C-reactive protein is above 1.0, every increment higher for that C-reactive protein, you might have a 20 to 25% increased risk for fracture. So let's go back to that 50-year-old woman we were talking about who had a negative 3.0. Let's say one of them had a C-reactive protein of a 3.0 and the other one had a 1.0. Well, the one with a 3.0 is going to have probably a 30, 35% increased risk of fracture. So we know that we have to bring that C-reactive protein down. We know that we have to bring the inflammation in her body down, because that inflammation is affecting the quality of her bone density, of her bone. And so there's different ways that you can look at through laboratory tests, and I talk a lot about these laboratory tests in my book.
And let's talk about them. Let's definitely go into them. You talked about C-reactive protein, and by the way, I find that most patients will be able to request that from their physician, and it will be covered by health insurance.
That's true.
So if they're now homocysteine, I don't find that's the case so often.
That's true too. I probably order homocysteine less so, but when I'm finding somebody that I can't find certain things wrong with them, I can't find what I call a therapeutic target. Therapeutic targets are laboratory tests that are off, that are wrong, that are abnormal, because we use those tests then to change them. And if I'm struggling to find something that's a little bit abnormal, you know, homocysteine is another good one to find, because the homocysteine can be correlated to that collagen, poor collagen formation. And some of the other tests is obviously vitamin D. Everybody should have a vitamin D test.
Absolutely. Now, that's an important one. Let's go into that.
Whether they have osteoporosis or not.
Right. And, you know, luckily, I have to say, because obviously you're interested in natural medicine, I've been studying functional medicine with Dr. Jeffrey Bland before he called it that, okay, mm-hmm. So for probably well over 30 years. But now, vitamin D has actually wheedled its way into the mainstream mindset.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And it's great, too.
Now, what kind of vitamin D test do you suggest to your patients?
Well, everybody needs what's called a 25-hydroxy vitamin D. And there's two essentially tests that people can get it. One is called 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, and that's the active form of vitamin D. And oftentimes, they used to test for that mostly, but most doctors now realize that that's the active form, and it can be actually normal when the storage form or the initial form of vitamin D, what's called 25-hydroxyvitamin D, can be abnormal, low. And so that's the one to test for, the 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And it should be at least 32 nanograms per ml, and probably up to 40 would be better, and keeping it between 40 and 60 nanograms per ml, which should be your ideal goal. And when you have your vitamin D tested, you should have it tested in February or March or something like that, because that's at the end of winter, or, you know, and the winter is when you don't get any benefit from the sun as far as making vitamin D. So your vitamin D will be the lowest at that time. And let's say you tested your vitamin D in August, when it's probably the highest, and it looked like it was 40 nanograms per ml. But then you didn't test it in March, and you're still taking the exact same amount. But because you are in the sun a little bit more than other people, you're actually going to lose a little bit more bone, or a little bit more bone density, vitamin D, because you are getting so much from the sun. Now in March, and it might go down to 25 or so. So you should have been taking a little bit more orally.
Well, thank you for that in-depth analysis. We're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're going to listen to The Natural Medicine Chest, which is a mini program that Dr. Zamperone and I have prepared. It gives you some information about specific herbs. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Keith McCormick, and we are talking about his new book, as well as osteoporosis, the whole body approach to osteoporosis. We'll be right back with more right here on PRN.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss an herb we all know and love, cinnamon.
Ah, spicy, sweet smell of cinnamon. Everyone recognizes the familiar aroma of this common kitchen spice. But did you know that cinnamon is an exotic plant bark with a long history of medicinal use in many countries throughout the world? Cinnamon was listed as an herb with medicinal properties in Chinese literature as early as 2700 BC. It is described in the Chinese medical text, the Tang Materia Medica, written in 659 AD. Cinnamon also enjoys traditional use in Ayurvedic medicine, the ancient healing art of India. It is mentioned in the Book of Moses and has been cultivated in Ceylon and Sri Lanka since 1200 AD, where much of the world's supply is still grown.
In Europe, cinnamon was regarded as a rare and precious spice. Many pharmaceutical substances, such as cough syrups and digestive tonics, contain cinnamon. It was also used as an incense and in perfumes. According to Chamberlain, writing in France in 1887, cinnamon possesses the greatest antiseptic properties. Cinnamon is gathered from the dried inner bark of the branches of a small tropical evergreen laurel tree. The bark is peeled off, and as the pieces are dried, they curl up into quills. These are the common cinnamon sticks that are used in herb teas and for baking.
In Chinese medicine, cinnamon is one of the most widely used warming herbs to aid in circulation and digestion. It is a common ingredient in small amounts in tea used for nausea during pregnancy. It is also used following delivery to decrease hemorrhage. Cinnamon raises vitality, warms and stimulates all the vital functions of the body, counteracts congestion, improves the digestive system, relieves abdominal spasms, and aids in peripheral circulation. The essential oils contained in cinnamon include eugenol, cinnamonic aldehyde, methyl eugenol, tannins, and mannitol, which give cinnamon its sweet flavor. It also contains cinzenolin and cinzenolol, which are both known insecticides.
Try putting some liquid soap and cinnamon in a spray bottle and use on plants as an organic bug repellent. Cinnamon is also included in many medicinal recipes that are used for lice, scabies, and other skin parasites. Cinnamon has antifungal, antiviral, and bactericidal activities. It has been shown to suppress E. coli, Staphylococcus, and Candida albicans.
So, listeners, next time you inhale that sweet, spicy aroma, remember there's more to cinnamon than meets the nose as you reach into your natural medicine chest.
Once again to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And Dr. Z and I do so many activities that you can join in on. Right now we are on a lecture tour throughout the Southeast. So if you have anyone in Florida, we'll be giving lectures almost every single night. Many of them are free and include giveaways of all kinds. Just go to naturalnurse.com under schedules. And that's something you can do at all times to find out where you can find us live. In addition, we have a very exciting schedule coming up in March where we are taking groups of people to the Caribbean, to Jamaica in particular, to actually live and study with Jamaican herbal bush doctors. And that course is a 3-college credit course accredited through Stony Brook University. And that is very, very exciting. That trip is almost filled, but we have space for another 2 or 3 people. So if you're interested, either go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or naturalnurse.com, email us, and let us know. We'll send you the registration information. You can get 3 college courses. And, of course, if you don't want the course credit and you just want to come along and have a wonderful education vacation at Echo Tours for Cures, you're welcome. So today we have as our guest Dr. Keith McCormick. And he is the author of a fabulous book that you need to know if you want to maintain your bones at maximum health and strength. And it's called Osteoporosis, What You Need to Know to Reduce Your Fracture Risk. You can always find Dr. McCormick at osteonaturals.com. That's osteo, O-S-T-E-O, naturals.com. And Dr. McCormick is a chiropractic physician, and he is in Western Massachusetts, and he specializes in nutritional management of patients with bone fragility. And he also was on studying, or I guess training, for the United States Olympic team. So he is a top-notch athlete in his own right. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. McCormick.
Hello, I'm here.
Now, we were discussing vitamin D.
Yep.
So we're going to pick up a little bit more on that.
Okay.
Because one thing I want to ask you. So vitamin D, as we talked about, had this marvelous uprising and recognition even within mainstream medicine. And more recently, and I'm sure you're pretty familiar with this because you probably follow the studies on it, there's been some indication that getting your levels too high is also really not where you want to go.
Well, I think anything should be taken in a certain extent in moderation, you know, and vitamin D is one of those things. And you know, vitamin D doesn't just increase a person's ability to absorb calcium from the gut, but vitamin D has a lot of input into the immune system. So when you're working with the immune system, you want to moderate it. You want to make sure it's healthy. You don't want to stimulate it too much. And the same with vitamin K. A lot of times you've seen people now using 45 milligrams of vitamin K, which to me it might be just a little bit too much. So I think, you know, it's good to bring your vitamin D levels up to a certain amount, 40 to 60 nanograms per ml. But when you get to 80 or 100 or 120, I think that's pushing it and just might cause other problems.
Okay, so now let's go a little bit deeper, because we're talking about vitamin D and we're talking about vitamin K, and there's so many forms. That's why when you go to the store, some bottles cost $25 and some bottles cost $2. So what should somebody be looking for to get the most optimum form of each of those individual nutrients?
It is very confusing, and I totally sympathize with consumers. Vitamin D should be in the vitamin D3 form, and not the vitamin D2 form, because D3 is better absorbed. That's called cholecalciferol. That's the form that you want. And vitamin K is essentially in two forms. It's vitamin K1 and vitamin K2. And the vitamin K2 typically has the two forms that are for sale, are the MK4 and the MK7. In the supplements that I have both. I have all three. I use K1 for people who their bone density just needs to be supported, because vitamin K1 has an incredibly important role in maintaining bone health, in that it activates or carboxylates a substance released by the osteoblast for building bone, and that's called osteocalcin. So unless you don't have, if you don't have enough vitamin K from where you get that mostly, it naturally is from vegetables, green leafy vegetables, is really high in vitamin K. But if you don't have enough K, then osteocalcin is not carboxylated. And when it's carboxylated, it does two general things that we think of, and that is that it helps nucleate the hydroxyapatite crystal and helps the hydroxyapatite crystal get into the collagen and make it hard. And it also acts as a toughening agent, a toughening factor. It makes that collagen supple but tough. So without good carboxylated osteocalcin from vitamin K, that won't happen. If a person has substantial bone loss, vitamin K2 is much better. And the MK4 and MK7 forms are the way to go. Most of the research has been done on the MK4, but MK7 may have a little bit longer half-life. We don't really know that, but I think it's always good to hedge your bets and do both types.
Now, Dr. McCormick, let me ask you this, sort of as a devil's advocate question, because I get it all the time. What about the massive number of patients, and I'm sure you see many of them, who are on warfarin, coumadin, and blood thinners, and they are told they can't eat any vegetables such as kale and vegetables that would naturally contain high amounts of vitamin K?
Yeah, that is a huge problem, and I've been reading a lot about different research projects that are looking at that now. I don't think there's a problem with 100 micrograms of vitamin K, but obviously everybody has to talk to their doctor about that. And, you know, when you start decreasing a person's vegetable intake, I think that's crossing another line as far as what may be healthier or appropriate for these people on warfarin, on the coumadins and things. But yes, these people need vitamin K also, and so they probably shouldn't be taking supplemental K, but for sure I think to restrict them from their vegetables, that might be going a little too far. But
well, I'll go further than you, because I think that's total madness.
It is.
Madness. And when I read the studies, and I really read these carefully because it's a topic that interests me quite a bit, the really latest research shows that, you know, these are isolated cases where people got increased bleeding
right.
when they were on Coumadin and then ate vegetables. And usually the situation is that someone who didn't usually eat green vegetables at a certain amount ongoingly suddenly went to a party and ate tons of salad and all
right.
kinds of vegetables one day,
mm-hmm.
which really, you know, shifted those levels tremendously. And so instead of saying the word you've used so often and intelligently, which is moderation, like start eating a bowl full or an amount daily,
right.
and then they can moderate the coumadin levels to your diet.
Yes.
Instead
yes.
of the other way around.
That's exactly right. They can analyze the coumadin levels and see how it is. But you're right. It has to be a steady state situation. And getting back to the vitamin K, when people are using the 45 milligrams, to me, that also might be too much, even though that's been all the rage lately because of the studies out of Japan that show that 45 milligrams of vitamin K2 at the MK4 form can improve bone health. But what they're doing is they're using this as a pharmacological agent. They're using it essentially as a drug. And the way I approach the body is, like my book, the name of my book actually is The Whole Body Approach to Osteoporosis. And the reason why that's so important is because the way you approach bone density, the way you approach osteoporosis is through a whole body approach, not by saying, oh, I'm going to throw in gobs of vitamin K and see if we can improve the bone. No, let's take the vitamin K, which is really important for depositing that calcium into the bone. So we get the vitamin D that helps us bring the calcium into our body through the gut and helps moderate that immune system. And then let's put it in the right place by the right amount of vitamin K. Too much vitamin K, I think, can cause other problems like decreased ability for energy metabolism and decreased testosterone production.
Well, hold that thought, Dr. Keith, because we're going to take a little break at this juncture because we're going to hear about some other fabulous shows that are available to our listeners here on Gary Knowles Network, the Progressive Radio Network. And to find out more about Dr. McCormick, you can always visit www.osteonaturals.com. And we'll be bringing him back on board right after we listen to these promos from PRN. Thank you for joining me today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, as we bring you the natural nurse and Dr. Z. And we have as our guest today Dr. Keith McCormick, and he is the author of The Whole Body Approach to Osteoporosis, How to Improve Bone Strength and Reduce Your Fracture Risk. And if you've been listening, you already know that Dr. McCormick is extremely knowledgeable in this topic. He was moved to become knowledgeable in it both through interest and through personal need, and that's probably the most motivational way to really get to know a topic, which he does. You can find him at Osteo, like bones, O-S-T-E-O, Naturals, osteonaturals.com. So thank you for joining us once again, Dr. Keith.
Hi, Ellen.
Now, you were telling us about various kinds of lab tests as well as supplements. I read some other research recently that I found interesting. It was about Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Mm-hmm. You might be familiar with that kind of yeast. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a study done by a company called BioStrath in Switzerland. And what they did is they looked at the cells that you brought up earlier, the osteoblasts, and the osteoclasts, and as we know, those things, that ratio is negatively affected when astronauts are in a condition of zero gravity. Mm-hmm. And what they found is when they did influence the cells with the Saccharomyces cerevisiae extract, the bones actually were able to withstand zero gravity conditions and not be broken down. So I thought that was an interesting new piece of information.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. That sounds really interesting.
Well, there's endless new research, It's just great. The whole story is we can take action. We can find out more.
And that's really important for people.
Yes, and you talk about therapeutic targets in your book, The Whole Body Approach. What do you mean by therapeutic targets?
What I do is when I have a patient with low bone density, I essentially do a basic core analysis with the lab tests. I have them do a comprehensive metabolic profile. It's a chemistry screen for various tests looking at things like calcium in the blood and making sure it's not too high. A CBC, I make sure that they have a celiac profile. We look for sensitivity for gluten. A lot of people with osteoporosis are sensitive to gluten in their diet from wheat, barley, and rye, and that can cause bone loss. So we look at that. We look at vitamin D, as I said before. We look at how much calcium they're losing in their urine, so we get a 24-hour urine calcium. We'll do a thyroid stimulating hormone just to make sure their thyroid isn't overactive, and maybe get homocysteine, C-reactive protein. And another one that's really important is what's called a bone resorption marker, and that's either N-telopeptide, C-telopeptide, or deoxypyridinoline. And these are tests that essentially measure how much collagen is in a person's urine or their blood. Because
tell us about that one again, because I'm sure that's new to many of our listeners.
Well, when the osteoclasts, and they're the cells that break down your bone, become too aggressive, or the osteoblasts become too sleepy and sickly and they can't produce enough bone, those are essentially the two reasons why a person has excessive bone loss. Either they have excessive degradation of bone, or not enough building up of the bone, not enough formation of the bone. One of those two. And a lot of times it's because the osteoclasts become too aggressive, especially if the person is in a state of chronic inflammation. And that's oftentimes the reason why a person has osteoporosis, is because of chronic inflammation, a perturbation of their immune system that creates too much pro-inflammatory cytokines, pro-inflammatory chemicals floating around their body that hyperstimulates the osteoclast to break down bone. So we can measure that by taking these bone resorption markers. Like I said, the one I typically use the most is a urine marker called N-telopeptide, and it measures, like I said, how much collagen, how aggressive those osteoclasts are breaking down the bone. If they're really aggressive, then a person's going to have more collagen in their urine and in their blood. So we can use this. You had asked about the therapeutic targets. We use these laboratory tests to being a sophisticated look at a person's body and saying, oh, they don't just have bone loss. Ah, they have hyperaggressiveness of their osteoclasts. They have too much inflammation. Oh, they have low vitamin D, so they have a problem with the immune system and a problem intake of the calcium. Oh, they have a low vitamin K, so they're not getting that vitamin K. They're not getting that calcium deposited into the bone. So we look at all these things through laboratory tests. We find lab tests that are abnormal. We make them what I call a therapeutic target. It's a target. It's a thing we're going to focus upon to try and improve. What happens today in people who are assessing people with osteoporosis is they're very narrowly looking at the bone density from a bone density examination, and that's all they're doing. I say, let's look at bone quality aspects, and if we can change those things, and we can look at to make sure that we're changing them by looking at blood tests, at urine tests, we're not just giving a person nutritional supplements and hoping for the best. We're using nutritional supplements to actually change laboratory tests. So we actually have an objective measure, these therapeutic targets, objective measure that they're getting better.
Now, why don't all doctors do this? I mean, it just makes so much sense.
It makes so much sense, doesn't it? I'm not quite sure that's an awfully good question. I think it's actually because, unfortunately, 99% of doctors don't know a lot about this. They are caring more about cancer and heart disease than they are about osteoporosis. But it shouldn't be that way, and the reason why is because osteoporosis is a chronic disease that has its basis in chronic inflammation. So do all the other chronic diseases, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's. They all have their basis within chronic inflammation. So if you can take a person with osteoporosis and improve them, we're improving their whole body, and they will have less chance of getting these other disorders too. So Yes, we should be looking at a person through all these lab tests and doing this in a sophisticated approach and not just in a, let's just harden that bone up and then that's it. There's still, their bone density might be harder, but they're still very unhealthy as a person.
Well, yeah, and you did describe why, because what I see that happens, for instance, when they're just doing the drug therapies, they get a better number because the outer coating might be maintained. It's not actually thickened, but may break down more slowly in terms of the bone. But the inner matrix, which actually gives the bone both its strength and flexibility,
is unchanged. Yep.
Unchanged or much worse.
Yes.
And I think what we're seeing now in the longer-term studies, and of course, even conventional medicine, people are reading these studies, is that those kinds of drug therapies are leading to things like more severe fractures.
Yes.
And a higher rate of fractures. So in other words, they are not having any good outcome over time.
When instead they could use things like berberine and alpha-lipoic acid and N-acetylcysteine, milk basic protein, taurine, all these things help that most people have never heard of for bone health, but those all help to improve the health of a bone and the health of a person's skeleton, and then as it improves in health, it will gain bone density also. But all those things I mentioned are really important factors for improving bone health.
It's just amazing that it is not more widespread knowledge among physicians, because it is really quite well documented by double-blind studies and research. Of course, one person it wouldn't help, or one entity it would not help, are the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, and on my website, I not only talk about all these various components, the supplements, that nutritional factors that can help bone density, but I also have a blog. So I'd like to push my blog a little
please
bit because I talk about all kinds of research out there that I essentially scour hundreds of research articles every week and every month, and I try to pick out research articles that I think will really benefit people to know about. And so I'm constantly at the University of Massachusetts reading journal articles from medical journals, and then I put them on my blog, and I kind of explain what's going on in the world of osteoporosis. So,
well, also, are you familiar with calcitonin, a much more old-fashioned drug where they just isolated? Tell us what your feelings are about that.
Well,
it seems to have a milder adverse event profile.
It definitely does. I don't think there's really anything that really causes problems with calcitonin. The only problem with that is your body essentially gets attenuated to it after about 2 years. So it does seem to increase bone density a little bit. It does seem to decrease fracture risk a little bit. Studies are conflicting in that. But the nice thing about it, it doesn't seem to cause major problems, number one. And number two, it doesn't work, though, for a long duration. What it is a good medication for, I think, is when a person has a compression fracture, if they can take calcitonin for the first month or two afterwards, it not only helps improve their bone density a little bit, but also decreases their pain. And a compression fracture can be very painful, and calcitonin is the only medication out there that is not only beneficial to bone, but actually decreases a person's pain.
Well, I guess we're done, so I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Get in touch with Dr. Keith McCormick at osteonaturals.com or us at naturalnurse.com. Until next week, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.